This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio. Here's your host, Dan Loney.
And welcome, everybody. It is August the 22nd. Great to have you with us here on Knowledge at Wharton. Dan Loney coming to you from our studios in Philadelphia. Pleasure to have you joining us for the next couple of hours. It appears that the United States is going to increase its presence in countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan to try and eliminate terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Speaking before a group of soldiers at Fort Myer, the president gave an overview of the situation, saying that his expectation originally had been to get out of those locations, but instead he has decided, potentially with advice from his generals, to move in further. That in itself will be a challenge since these groups have expanded into so many new areas. And Spain, seen once as a relatively safe haven in comparison to places like France and England, now has been placed in the middle of all of the recent terrorist attacks. To take a look at the president's speech, we are joined by Ian Lustig, who is political science professor here at the University of Pennsylvania, and by Daniel Markey, senior research professor in international relations at Johns Hopkins University. Ian, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Daniel, great to have you with us as well.
Glad to join you.
Ian, to start with you, your reaction to the speech in general last night?
Well, it was nice to see him in his calm mood on script. But my overall impression, frankly, is that this is not a strategy. This is a posture. That's not surprising because there are not very many, if any, good strategies, that is really significant, rational, careful plans going forward that would with confidence lead us from here to victory, at least not within the limits of what Americans have come to imagine as possible in American foreign policy. So I see it as a lot of huffing and puffing, a lot of attempt to make us look tough and mean, and that we will not be suckers. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the main message to the American people. I'm going to be tough, and we're not going to be suckered. But that's not really a strategy.
Daniel?
Yeah, I would agree with that. The one observation I would make, which maybe is a little bit more charitable, would be it could have been much, much worse.
You're right.
And it could have looked like, I mean, from my perspective, that could have been one of the more extreme options that seemed to be on the table, either, even as the president mentioned, a kind of a rapid, precipitous withdrawal, which seemed to be something that he may have favored during the campaign, or at the other extreme, some kind of a major ramp up and possibly the transfer of authority from the U.S. military or U.S. forces over to some sort of mercenary army. Of the sort that Eric Prince and Blackwater fame might have preferred. So there were some things that seemed to be on the table. Not sure exactly how seriously we should have taken them, but they would have been considerably worse.
But it is interesting, and you both bring it up, the fact that in terms of the president delivering that speech, and you brought up right at the top, that he was very calm in terms of delivering that. And in what we have seen over the last couple of months, calm is certainly a better option than what we have seen with some of the rhetoric, fire and fury being, you know, where North Korea is concerned. So I think from that perspective, people probably have a small sense that this was OK, but it's still not 100%, you know, totally where we need to see the president of the United States.
Well, let's move a little bit away from the president's own delivery and what he said into the there were a few specifics of changes that will be made or have been made. I think the most concrete, which was repeated several times, was the fact that the rules of engagement for our forces have been loosened. The restrictions, as he mentioned many times, that have been imposed on the use of military force by lower-level military commanders have been removed, all with the idea of killing terrorists, a phrase that he seemed to enjoy repeating. The point is that when you do that, you tend to get these very ugly and politically disastrous collateral damage incidents, because there is no vetting or less vetting from a higher level, allowing commanders to make all kinds of errors in the field,
which then
drive the population toward the Taliban, producing embarrassment in the military and ultimately military requests to be supervised.
Yeah.
So we saw this, I think, early on in the Trump administration in Syria, where there was a series of these collateral damage incidents following the loosening of restrictions. I expect that something like this may happen in Afghanistan as well.
Daniel?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is true. Of course, we've been through that for years in Afghanistan. So the big issue here is that there's not a lot that's terribly new. The Obama administration had ramped up, had surged forces, had expanded rules of engagement in many ways, practically, if not on paper, and then had clamped down in the hope that that surge would have taken, that the Afghan forces would be stood up, and that the U.S. Could sort of basically depart, withdraw. This signals a reversal of that later Obama phase.
Right.
In my mind, it looks a great deal like a Clinton administration would have looked like. I had trouble seeing much difference, with one major exception, and that would be that I have to imagine that if a Clinton administration were in there today, they would have put in place a serious diplomatic team, and that we could point to that team as potentially responsible for advancing a political solution that would have included the Afghan Taliban and Kabul,
right,
regional players. Right now, the State Department is in such disarray that it's hard to put your finger on who would manage that process. And really, it's hard to see how a minor surge of the sort that the administration is talking about now, without a major political or diplomatic surge, will have any chance of success.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree. I think, though, that when you're listening to a speech like this, you have to understand that this is not written by the president,
right,
or even by a speechwriter, in the sense that it's a negotiated text in which different parts of the staff or different parts of the administration are trying to score points for their position. In that context, the few references to all forms of American power will be integrated,
right,
is a bow to the idea that we have to use diplomacy and intelligence, not just force. So there is that voice in the administration, obviously, or you wouldn't
right.
have had that.
I would just say I think there's every chance that that was McMaster himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whole of government
yeah.
approach is something that the military has been calling
yes.
for. I think it's as likely that that came from that part of the White House, at least, as that it came from Tillerson or anybody over at the
Probably
State Department.
More likely. You're right. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, here's a little clip of the president from last night speaking at Fort Myer down in Virginia.
We must address the reality of the world as it exists right now, the threats we face, and the confronting of all of the problems of today, and extremely predictable consequences of a hasty withdrawal. We need look no further than last week's vile, vicious attack in Barcelona to understand that terror groups will stop at nothing to commit the mass murder of innocent men, women, and children. You saw it for yourself. Horrible. As I outlined in my speech in Saudi Arabia 3 months ago, America and our partners are committed to stripping terrorists of their territory, cutting off their funding, and exposing the false allure of their evil ideology.
So here's the interesting piece of that. And obviously, you know, that was just one piece of it. Going off of what you were both saying, Daniel, it is interesting, though, that this speech comes, 48 hours after Steve Bannon is pushed out of the White House. And it's been well documented that Steve Bannon and H.R. McMaster did not get along. So I wonder if that truly is the case, is the timing of delivering this speech just as important because of the fact that maybe McMaster has, you know, won confidence from President Trump?
I think for the moment, McMaster is victorious. I think Bannon's
yeah.
departure is a real sign of that. Kelly wants to make things more, shall we say, normal and systematic within the White House. reading from a teleprompter all the way through the speech, as far as I could tell, is an indication of that. If I could make a point related to the comments that Trump was just had of him, this connection of global terrorism, of attacks by groups like ISIS in places like Spain or elsewhere around the world to Afghanistan, is on one level true, and on another level we need to be careful about that.
Right.
It is true that Afghanistan has been a safe haven, has been a haven for international terrorists, including Al-Qaeda. It is also true that the insurgency, which is principally driven by the Taliban, is not 100% an international terrorist group. And I think that if there's any chance of bringing about some kind of a negotiated settlement, it's going to be in the United States and other parties trying to draw a line, a difficult line, between international terrorists and Afghan insurgents. Afghan insurgents presumably you can strike a deal with of some sort. International terrorists, you can't. And it's that has been at the core of the problem for U.S. policy basically from the start, an inability to draw that line or to draw it clearly enough to advance a political process.
And I completely agree. I think there's a danger of the American people being reintroduced to a drama that they had in Iraq that they would not want to repeat. And that drama is that you have you had in Iraq a situation where there were people in Washington that wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
The American people didn't particularly care to do that, but they were very afraid of terrorism. So they called Iraq an international terrorism threat, and it ended up that we were in Iraq for a decade because of the mischaracterization of that situation.
Yeah.
Here we're already in Afghanistan for no particularly good reason anymore, but we can't get out without it being actually producing, if we just got out, a vacuum where terrorists would take advantage of it. So the problem has to be defined, or is being defined by the president in that clip, as if the problem in Afghanistan is international terrorism, when, as Daniel just mentioned, it really is a Muslim fundamentalist insurgency within the country by the Taliban. And that means, for our strategy, that to the extent we just unleash firepower, we will essentially withdraw politically and create the vacuums that and the support system for international terrorists. But if we go the other direction, all of these directions are hinted at in the speech, and support state building, not nation building, but state building, then we're going to be there for an unlimited amount of time.
Well, and that's a key point to this, because right now in various portions of Afghanistan, I mean, that country is rubble. And so, you know, any kind of building in Afghanistan is going to take an extended period of time and an extended presence by the United States. You brought up an interesting diagram that was in the Wall Street Journal today about the numbers of troops that had been put into that region, and it really started, you know, at the push of the recession here in the United States around 2008, 2009, the numbers of troops that went in there were phenomenal. The numbers of troops that have come out are, you know, almost just as many.
Yeah, it's very strange to think of Obama as weak in Afghanistan. If you see the arc of American troops rising and falling under the Bush administration, it never had troops higher than about 35,000.
Right.
Immediately, almost immediately, Obama shot the number of troops of American troops up to 100,000, and they were there for years, only dropping down in 2013-14 to levels where they are now.
Yeah.
And it's, even if all of the 4,000 people talk about go in, it'll be a drop in the bucket compared with what the effort Obama was making. I'm not saying that we should go in that direction. I'm just saying that it's a false image of now we're going to be strong, then we were weak.
Yeah.
That is true. If I could just say on that, that's definitely true, and that's a strong reason to believe that no reasonable amount of additional military force on the U.S. side is going to solve this problem in a way that the Obama administration couldn't. The one sticking criticism that, of course, Trump and others have made about Obama is that he went in with a pretty clear timeline. He imposed that on his military. They weren't thrilled about it, but they were willing to accept it, possibly because they didn't believe he'd actually stick to it. He did stick to it. 18 months was really the height of the surge. After that, it began to come down pretty dramatically. He was true to his word, and he had asked his commanders whether they could deliver with that number of troops in that amount of time. They said they could. They didn't. Since then, the shift, really the more significant shift, has been an attempt to focus on building up Afghan national security forces as U.S. forces drew down. And that's had certain successes, but not nearly enough to make up for the vacuum, the power vacuum that major U.S. withdrawal has left behind. So it's been both. Obama was strong, and then he also imposed some serious limitations on the use of force and the amount of force that he was willing to use for a variety of reasons.
And I think that opens the door to a deeper understanding of what's going on. The American people will be perhaps somewhat impressed by the repeated idea that you don't give the enemy the time when you're going to downsize, that this was a mistake that Obama made, without understanding what policymakers know very well, which is that the rationale for producing that timeline, for saying we're going to be there for 18 months, not an unlimited time, is because the main problem is to end corruption and to get the Afghan government to act as an actual partner and as a coherent force. And if there is no deadline, if they are given the message that President Trump gave them, which no matter what, we're going to be there for a long time, then they just go on bilking the system for their lower level.
If I could say, I agree with that, except I think Trump's message was actually more confusing.
Yes, it was. He said it both ways. But
exactly. He said simultaneously, we don't do nation building. And then he later talked, and that we do support a continued commitment to the Afghan government. But then he said, unless they get their act together, we can't. This is not a blank check.
Right. Well,
so he actually wants to have it both ways.
If not all four or five ways, which is what really both turn the country into some kind of American base isolated from the Afghan people that just drops bombs on terrorists and uses the location to mobilize India against China and Pakistan, or to contain the violence so that whatever happens in Pakistan doesn't affect the United States, but it does turn Pakistan into a kind of a charnel house, or if not to build a nation, to build a state, that is, build the Afghan army and the Afghan apparatus, or to achieve reconciliation and negotiations eventually with the Taliban, which is something else he mentioned, which requires a whole different set of diplomatic and military approaches to problems. So that's what I think both of us are saying, that there were so many directions in this speech, so many of the isolated pieces of wisdom, if they are wisdom, that are around in the policy world, that it's hard to call it a strategy as opposed to a posture of toughness of saying you're not going to be suckered anymore by the Pakistanis or by the Afghans.
So Dan, how do you think it probably should have been formulated by President Trump? Because as I kind of mentioned at the top, I mean, saying that you want to try and tackle terrorism is such a hard thing these days because it is so spread out. It's almost becoming an issue that is best handled by the countries themselves, with potentially support from NATO or maybe the United States on its own, whatever it might be. So how should maybe the president really brought forth this idea?
Well, as a broad approach, the desire to push Pakistan harder, to lend a helping hand to Afghanistan, to demonstrate our commitment with India as well. I don't have huge problems with any of these things. It's really sort of that next step, which is, so how are we really going to get to that or head in that direction? What sorts of resources, what sort of people, what are the follow-on events that you anticipate? Those are the kinds of things that I would have wanted to hear more about. Now, maybe that's unrealistic for a presidential speech, so I'll be waiting to see what I hear in the next, the coming days and weeks from administration officials. But there are some real gaps, as I pointed out before. If you really believe that it's you use a slightly larger hammer and pound it a little bit harder, but principally as a means to inspire a political process, then you really have to tell me who and how do you think you're going to do a political process with. How are you going to do it better than you did it last time? And when I see such a hollowed out State Department and don't hear a lot of energy on the diplomatic front more broadly, you know, I have real questions there. If you tell me that you want to use an additional 4,000 troops on the ground, then I want to know, are they really for fighting terrorists, killing terrorists? Are you still invested in the broader training and assisting of Afghan national security forces? What are your real priorities there? Because there are going to be trade-offs. That number of forces really isn't enough to do all that much more. Over the coming days and weeks, we should probably expect or listen for whether the CIA will be doing additional things that you know, that didn't come up in the speech. What about drones in Pakistan? What are the, if Pakistan doesn't listen, what are we prepared to do about that? So there's a lot of kind of gap filling that needs to come, some of which I think is reasonable to expect should have been in this speech, some of which probably will have to wait.
All right.
Yeah, I'd say something perhaps odd in that there's a sense in which we shouldn't be picking on President Trump about this issue. It is such a tough issue. I know Daniel mentioned what a Clinton administration would look like.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in the summer issue of Foreign Affairs, Tim Kaine,
Virginia,
Hillary Clinton's vice presidential candidate, had an extremely long article on American grand strategy and what it should be, what it would have been under a Clinton administration, and what it should be under a Trump administration. And in that long article that went all the way across the globe, the word Afghanistan does not appear. It does not even appear in the article. In other words, Tim Kaine has not a clue as to not only what to do in Afghanistan, but how whatever we should do in Afghanistan fits into this larger framework. I thought that was telling about how difficult it is. I said at the beginning that what makes it difficult is that within the context of what Americans imagine is possible in American foreign policy, because one key probably to a rational approach to Afghanistan is to involve Iran. Iran is closely tied to the Hazara, the Shia in that country. The country is devolved to ethnic warlord kinds of centers of power. And the Iranians could be, they have no, there's no love lost between them and the Taliban. They're arch enemies.
Right.
The United States, in that context, if the United States looked at Afghanistan as something that could be partitioned in some way into areas under the suzerainty of neighboring states, Uzbek, Pashtun, Pakistani, Iranian, with an American or NATO enclave around Kabul, Tajikistan, we could see a different kind of future of UN trusteeships that would deal with Afghanistan where the power is in Afghanistan, which is not in Kabul, which is no longer in the traditional tribal hands, but in the ethnic warlords and that combination. But we can't do that because think of the idea of partnering with Iran is outside the boundaries of American politics.
There's really no way, I think, Daniel, to see with this administration a partnering with Iran on pretty much anything at this point, correct?
That's true. I mean, obviously the administration's rhetoric on Iran is pretty harsh, hawkish. Let me make a couple of observations. I mean, one, even when we've had pretty bad relations with Iran, it turns out that at least at some level, our interests and Iranian interests in Afghanistan align. I don't want to make too much of that, but they have concerns about drugs coming out of Afghanistan, and they certainly have concerns about the instability and insecurity on their own border. So we have had some opportunities for alignment there. I would, however, push back on the idea of seeing Afghanistan as a kind of a divided, ultimately a country that should be under multiple different, I don't know, almost warlord-like regions, zones, ethnically defined. I mean, I think it is absolutely true that a strong Kabul is unlikely in our lifetimes. And so at a political level, in terms of a centralized political authority in Kabul, that's true. But the problem of Afghanistan is not that it's actually been forever a series of warring nations. It's that actually different groups around Afghanistan have wanted to control all of Afghanistan. there is a national identity, and I think that that shouldn't be lost here. And the fact that the Taliban, Pashtun Taliban, and others want to control Kabul, want to dictate what's happening there, is because it's a meaningful national contest. And there have been others over the years. I think for a while, Biden was pushing the idea of breaking the country up. On the opposite side, Bob Blackwell, a Republican, also had this idea of breaking the country up into pieces. I think the least interested people on earth in that solution are the Afghans themselves. So, yes, devolution of kind of a federal structure, absolutely. But the actual breaking up of the country, absolutely not. That's, I think, a misread of the problem of Afghanistan.
Okay. The whole globe is allergic to the idea of officially breaking up a country. But so that's why I talk about UN prestige ships, looking forward to a day when that doesn't have to be the case. The idea that Kabul, that there's an Afghan national idea, which there is, and that requires some kind of sacrifice for it on the part of the rest of the world is unconvincing. I think a lot of what makes Kabul important to these rival factions is all the money that streams through it to whoever nominally controls Kabul or who has officially won the last election. It's the money that produces the billions of dollars and the opportunities for Swiss bank accounts and for payoffs to lower level clients that determines why Kabul is so nationally important. If that weren't there, if the money were going into different places, into Herat or into as well as Kabul or to other places, Jalalabad, then the focus of these groups would also change.
I don't want to get too hung up on this, but I would say this was true for the couple of decades before the latest round of the civil war, right? There was a civil war for control of the country. The Taliban weren't content to allow certain parts of the country not to be under their control. They were fighting for every square inch. And that was without international support coming in through Kabul. So many motivations. If I could, I think just getting back to the broader speech, two other big issues came up here. One is Pakistan and one is India.
Yeah.
And then there's the overarching issue of a South Asia approach. I would say this was not a South Asia strategy speech. It was an Afghanistan strategy speech, which had limited waves of the hand to these other two countries. But the waves of the hand were entirely opposite. That is, the Pakistan wave was the back of the hand, perhaps across the cheek. And the wave to India was a kind of a cursory, friendly wave, like, couldn't you possibly do more here to help us out? I thought that was quite revealing, not so much of, again, to come back to this point, of a strategy that's likely to work, but a tone and a mood and a trajectory that we're on with the two big countries of South Asia and with India, a huge country that goes well beyond its region. That's an interesting and important point to make. It's not unique to Trump. We were on a similar trajectory with Obama, and as I say, I think we would have been on a similar trajectory with Clinton. But it's important, and the Pakistanis are responding to it, and they're not happy.
Great to have you both with us. Thank you, Daniel, for joining us on the phone today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ian, great to see you again. Thank you for coming in. It's Sirius XM 111, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.